It's Wednesday, October 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Coming up, President Trump criticizes Saudi Arabia for the death of journalist Jamal Khashoggi.
Bad deal, should have never been thought of. Somebody really messed up, and they had the worst cover-up ever.
Also ahead, its National Security Advisor Bolton meets with Russian President Putin. The UN says a famine in Yemen could be worse than expected. A migrant caravan continues across Mexico. And how has the trade war affected American farmers? That's all on today's International Edition. Thanks for being with us on this Wednesday. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said Tuesday, the United States has identified at least some of the Saudi officials involved in the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi and is revoking their visas. Speaking at the State Department, Pompeo said that the State Department would continue to work with Congress and other nations to hold accountable those responsible for Khashoggi's death.
We are taking appropriate actions, which include revoking visas, entering visa lookouts, and other measures. We are also working with the Treasury Department to review the applicability of global Magnitsky sanctions to those individuals. These penalties will not be the last word on this matter from the United States. We will continue to explore additional measures to hold those responsible accountable.
Pompeo said the United States does not tolerate what he called this ruthless kind of action to silence a journalist through violence. Earlier Tuesday, Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said Khashoggi was murdered in a ferocious manner. In a speech to the Turkish parliament, Erdogan said that Saudi Arabia carried out the killing in its Istanbul consulate in a premeditated plot. He dismissed Riyadh's claim that rogue agents were responsible. My colleague Sarah Williams spoke with reporter Dorian Jones in Istanbul about what the speech could mean for relations between Ankara and Riyadh.
So this was a very strong speech against Riyadh, but it has to be said it could have been a lot worse for Riyadh because there was the expectation he would talk about these tapes and video recordings that leaks from the investigation claim that they have that recorded the last minutes of Khashoggi's life, where investigators say he was tortured, then executed, and then his body dismembered. President Erdogan did not even talk about those tapes, and crucially, he did not attribute direct blame for the killing of Khashoggi to the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman. There was expectations he possibly could. So I think there's quite a lot of relief both in Riyadh and in Washington over this speech.
Yeah, there has been, as you said, a lot of speculation about those tapes. There had been reports that it could have come from Khashoggi's Apple Watch. But then, of course, there were reports that the Saudi consulate in Istanbul had been bugged.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is one possible explanation why Turkey hasn't released these tapes, if they do have them. In fact, U.S. President Donald Trump has alluded to the fact that they may not even exist. And the reason, one possible explanation why they haven't been presented is that it would reveal that the Turkish security forces had been bugging the Istanbul Saudi consulate. Now, that is a complete no-no under international diplomatic law and would be quite embarrassing for the Turkey to admit to this. But having said that, other observers have said that the fact that Turkish security forces have admitted that these tapes do exist underlines that they have already probably compromised the Istanbul consulate. But I think there will be relief that they haven't been released, although the CIA chief, Gina Haspel, has flown into Ankara today to reportedly examine these tapes if they do exist. Now, up until now, the Turkish foreign minister speaking today said that they will not be sharing these tapes with anyone. So there's still a lot of conjecture whether these tapes exist and what's on them.
Erdogan seemed to be sensitive to offending members of Saudi Arabia's royal family. I've also read that some observers said that he has to be particularly careful not offending the king, never mind the crown prince.
Yeah, that's right. It's quite interesting. He really was very careful in his language, showing a lot of respect to King Salman, who he has been speaking with during this crisis. President Erdogan, it's no secret, has very bad relations with the crown prince, but still has pretty good ties with the king, who he has known for many years. So he again followed this line that he showed a lot of respect there. And this is fueling speculation that there is some possible deal that is slowly being hammered out between Ankara, Riyadh, and possibly Washington as well. Although Ankara has been very clear publicly, they insist that there will be no whitewashing of the investigation. There will be no secret deals. But analysts and people that are close to the presidency have been speculating for some time that some deal is in the offing, that Riyadh will have to pay a very considerably high price for some exit strategy from this diplomatic crisis. One possible concession Riyadh is probably now expected to make is that President Erdogan has called for the 18 people that have been detained by Saudi authorities in connection with the death of Khashoggi, that they should be tried in Turkey. Now, that is a big leap, but that will be a big concession from Riyadh, but this could be the possible first steps in some sort of long-term deal between the two countries to resolve this crisis.
Later Tuesday in Washington, President Donald Trump criticized the Saudi cover-up of the killing, saying that it was one of the worst in history. However, the president repeated his assertion that Saudi Arabia is a key U.S. ally in the region and has plans to buy billions of dollars worth of U.S. military equipment.
Look, Saudi Arabia has been a really great ally. They've been one of the biggest investors, maybe the biggest investor in our country. They are doing hundreds of billions of dollars worth of investments and, you know, so many jobs, thousands and thousands of jobs. And if you look at the other side, Iran, you look at what they've done to people, vicious, horrible. And that's no excuse for what happened with Saudi Arabia, no excuse whatsoever. But you take a look, it's a rough part of the world. It's a nasty place. It's a nasty part of the world. But if what happened happened, and if the facts check out, it's something that's very bad. At the same time, they have been a very good ally of ours. They've been helping us a lot with respect to Israel. They've been funding a lot of things.
In Jordan, meanwhile, Human Rights Watch called on Turkey to ask the UN Secretary General to appoint a special investigative team to look into Khashoggi's killing. Adam Kugel is the Middle East researcher for Human Rights Watch.
Saudi Arabia has, for many years, had a horrible human rights record, and many issues have gone unresolved. This unique opportunity, given how much pressure Saudi is under, offers the world community a chance to really zero in on areas that need reform and to push Saudi Arabia to really, truly modernize their society, including when it comes to human rights.
Kugel said that Saudi Arabia's claim that Khashoggi was killed in a fist fight appears to be an attempt to insulate Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman from scrutiny and to prevent full accountability. Among the top stories in the world, U.S. to revoke visas of Saudis implicated in Khashoggi's death, UN expert on human rights welcomes thaw on Korean Peninsula, Syria's food production hits 29-year low, UN staff to help migrants with asylum claims, and Native Americans don't want their children taken away. Expanded coverage of these stories and more is on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Thanks for being with us. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. The Trump administration appears determined to pull out of a key 1987 arms control agreement with Russia after National Security Advisor John Bolton met in Moscow with President Vladimir Putin. President Trump has accused Russia of violating the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty by deploying missiles. Speaking at a meeting with the Russian president in Moscow Tuesday, U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton said plans are being made for President Trump to meet with his Russian counterpart next month in Paris on the sidelines of a celebration to mark 100 years since the end of World War I.
President Trump would look forward to seeing you in Paris on the sideline of the celebration of the 100th anniversary of the armistice. Because despite our differences, which exist because of our different national interests, it's still important to work in areas where there's a possibility of mutual cooperation.
For his part, Russia's president expressed surprise at Trump's plan to pull out of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty.
Recently, we've heard about the U.S. intention to pull out from the intermediate-range nuclear forces treaty. We are aware of the doubts on the side of the American administration regarding the extension of the New START treaty. We are aware of and we've been hearing the intentions on the side of the U.S. To deploy certain elements of the ABM system in space.
Putin said through a translator that his last meeting with President Trump in Helsinki had been useful and that he was open to another such meeting in France with Trump if the American president agrees.
And of course, it would be very useful to continue direct talks with the U.S. president. First of all, on the sidelines of multilateral events, which are going to take place very soon. Let's say in Paris, of course, if the American side is interested in such contacts.
Bolton said later that Washington is convinced that Russia has violated the INF and had been in violation since 2013.
With respect to the question of Russian compliance, as I've said, it is the American position that Russia's in violation. It is Russia's position that they're not in violation. So one has to ask, how do you convince the Russians to come back into compliance with obligations they don't think they're violating?
Asked if he thought Moscow would come into compliance, Bolton said, it was difficult to believe since Russia has been denying it is in violation of the treaty. Bolton also said that activity by nations not covered by the treaty, including China, Iran, and North Korea, remains a concern since those nations have made what he called very substantial strides to develop intermediate-range nuclear capability. The UN aid chief warned Tuesday that humanitarians are losing the fight against famine in Yemen and that 14 million people could soon be at risk of starvation. Mark Lowcock told a meeting of the UN Security Council that the famine is much bigger than anything anyone has seen in their lifetimes.
While we await the results of the assessments now underway, we already know that a further year of war and economic crisis have pushed millions more Yemenis towards famine. So, just to be clear, my assessment, my advice to you, is that there is now a clear and present danger of an imminent and great big famine engulfing Yemen, much bigger than anything any professional in this field has seen during their working lives.
Lowcock has warned before of the risk of famine two separate times last year, but a significant scaling up of the humanitarian response and the end of a Saudi-led coalition blockade on Yemen helped avoid a worst-case scenario. He did say that a UN assessment in September that about 11 million people could be at risk was wrong, and a revised review puts the number significantly higher.
Our revised assessment, the results of new survey work and analysis, is that the total number of people facing pre-famine conditions, meaning they're entirely reliant on external aid for survival, could soon reach not 11 million, but 14 million. That's half the total population of the country.
The aid chief said that after nearly 4 years of conflict and struggling to survive, millions of Yemenis are physically more vulnerable as they are less able to withstand hunger, cholera, and disease. One of the main culprits driving the food crisis is the collapse of the national economy. Yemen imports 90% of its food, fuel, and medicines, and the devaluation of the national currency has impeded imports. Clashes around the country's most important seaport, Hodeidah, are also hindering food distribution. A main road from the city to the densely populated northern city of Sana'a remains blocked, affecting trade and aid convoys. A Saudi Arabia-led coalition began bombing Houthi rebels in support of the Yemeni government in March of 2015. Since then, the UN estimates that more than 10,000 people have been killed, mostly due to airstrikes. Political efforts to end the crisis have mostly stalled since the Houthis skipped September's UN-brokered talks in Geneva with the Yemeni government. A caravan of several thousand migrants from Central America stopped briefly Tuesday in Mexico to rest and to mourn the passing of one of its members. Meanwhile, here in Washington, President Donald Trump continued his assertion that what he called Middle Easterners have infiltrated the wave of refugees in an attempt to reach the United States.
They've intercepted a lot of different people, but among the people they've intercepted very recently are people from the Middle East, okay? So you can't be surprised when you hear it. You've heard that before. It happens all the time. And I spoke to him literally last night. I spoke to another one this morning. Very good relationship with Border Patrol and ICE. And they say it happens all the time from the Middle East.
Speaking to reporters in the Oval Office, Trump said that he had very good information that terrorists could be in the caravan. However, when pressed, the president acknowledged that there is no proof that terrorist operatives are part of the thousands making their way across Mexico.
They intercept.
That they're in the caravan.
Well, they could very well be.
But there's no proof.
There's no proof of anything. There's no proof of anything. But they could very well be. If you look at what that was building, you know, they were talking about 5,000 or 6,000 people. I'm pretty good at estimating crowd size, as you probably have figured out.
Trump has criticized Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador for not stopping people from leaving their countries. He said in a tweet on Monday that the U.S. would now begin cutting off or substantially reducing the massive foreign aid routinely given to them. The president has also threatened to use the U.S. military to close down the United States' southern border. Meanwhile, the UN Refugee Agency has sent dozens of staff to southern Mexico to help stabilize the chaotic situation and screen the asylum claims of many of the thousands of people in the caravan. Lisa Schlein has details from Geneva.
More than 45 UN refugee staff have arrived in Tapachula in Chiapas State, Mexico, and others are on their way. The UNHCR says conditions on the ground appear to be somewhat calmer and more orderly than in previous days. But UNHCR spokesman Adrian Edwards says with some 7,000 desperate people on the move, the situation could change at any time.
Of particular concern for us at the moment is the developing humanitarian situation among this group, with many people having food, water, health and other needs. There's also kidnapping and security risks in areas the caravan may venture into. Stabilizing the situation is therefore urgent.
Edwards says UNHCR teams are registering asylum seekers, identifying those who are particularly vulnerable with specific needs. He says increasing aid and providing more shelter is essential. He says so far about 1,000 people have sought asylum in Mexico. He adds thousands more are likely to continue on toward the United States. He tells VOA some will be in need of international protection.
All countries have a right to be able to manage their own immigration and manage their own borders. What is important for us is that those borders are managed in an asylum-sensitive way, which means giving people access, assessing their claims, and then dealing with them accordingly in line with international law.
Edwards says individuals fleeing persecution and violence must be given access to the country where they are seeking asylum and the right to apply. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The caravan, estimated to include more than 7,000 people, has advanced about 75 kilometers since crossing the border from Guatemala into Mexico. It still faces more than 1,600 kilometers to the closest U.S. border crossing at McAllen, Texas. Coming up on VOA's International Edition, we'll hear how the Trump administration's trade war with China is affecting Midwestern farmers, and some technology used to photograph Mars could help fight air pollution on Earth. You're listening to VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Farmers in the American Midwest are working the fields this autumn amid a trade dispute between the United States and China, once one of the largest importers of U.S. corn and soybeans. As VOA's Kane Faribault reports, uncertainty looms over how it will ultimately affect farm income this year, as growers have yet to feel the full impact or benefits of the escalating trade dispute.
Among the mounting concerns, Illinois farmer Bob Gerke is juggling. He is racing against the clock to harvest his corn and soybeans. Bob spends up to 14 hours a day in the fields.
Biggest concern right now, we're harvesting, that we don't get stuck and we get the crops out before Mother Nature throws snow at us.
But his worries don't end there.
The marketer's advice, even this spring, never was calling for soybeans to go down this extreme, but they weren't thinking there was going to be a tariff.
Bob is talking about Chinese tariffs on U.S. grain products, a retaliatory move after the United States slapped tariffs on Chinese steel and aluminum. It's brought down soybean prices as much as $2 this year.
That's a big deal for a farmer who's counting on that yield and that farm income.
Tamara Nelson, Senior Director of Commodities for the Illinois Farm Bureau, is concerned.
This is a fifth straight year of lower farm income. I think the second lowest farm income since 2012.
Nelson says news of a pending trade agreement between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada to replace NAFTA so far isn't doing much to put farmers at ease.
Whether or not that was achieved because of the tariff threats remains to be seen, because the steel and aluminum tariffs still remain on Mexico and Canada, and their retaliatory tariffs threatened against us still remain.
Farmer Bob Gerke had hoped decades of negotiations and relationships in China would be paying off, reversing declining farm income by keeping one of the largest markets for U.S. soybeans open.
And we've built trade up to where it was working. And now within a matter of 6 months, a lot of that has been knocked down, maybe even devastated, to where will it come back? How long it's going to take to come back?
The U.S. Department of Agriculture's $12 billion aid package was supposed to be a silver lining while it helps offset his lower soybean prices.
They're saying that we would get, I believe it's $1.60 or $1.65 a bushel.
Gerke says it doesn't help his corn.
It's a penny. Well, why even bother if you're going to give us a penny? That's more paperwork than it's worth. And then in their package, what they present, $200 million is for market development. It's like, we had the market. That's sort of a joke.
Soybeans are still being sold around the world, even if they might not be going to China. Sales to Europe and Argentina are up this year. So the question remains, are the trade tactics adopted by President Trump and his administration ultimately working?
That's probably the $64,000 question.
I think if you ask most farmers right now, they'll say no. You ask them maybe a year from now, 6 months from now, it might change their mind.
6 months from now, Gerke himself will be in a very different mindset, shifting gears from harvesting his crops to planting seeds in the ground for a new growing season, a season he hopes is filled with more certainty. Kane Faribault, VOA News, Elgin, Illinois.
The technology used in space missions can be expensive, but it has some practical benefits here on Earth. As Tina Trin tells us, researchers at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh are using high-resolution photographic technology used on Mars to analyze air pollution here on our planet.
Anirudh Sharma isn't an artist, but he and his team have come up with a creative way to tackle air pollution.
What we are saying is that while the pollution is being released in the environment, why don't you capture it? And once you capture it, make use of that pollution rather than throwing it into a waste stream.
Sharma and his colleagues at Gravity Labs are taking pollutants from diesel engine and chimney emissions and turning them into ink.
We have a plasma-based emission control technology that fits onto the exhaust of the tailpipes of the generators and chimneys. and without affecting the performance of the engine or the chimney, it captures all the pollution that would have otherwise gone into the environment.
Air ink is made of black carbon that has been purified and turned into a pigment base for inks and paints. About 50 minutes of diesel car pollution goes into markers like these. The product takes its cues from history, when the first inks were made from the black soot of oil lamps.
There were mosques that were painted in Turkey by an architect called Sinai, who used to take the lamp black from the lamp that was burned in the night and write poetry and calligraphy on the walls.
Air ink isn't available for purchase, but through artist partnerships, the startup is taking over public spaces with its own message of environmental awareness.
It's more of a activism tool. It's more of a branding tool. So people believe in it. It gets people started to talk about pollution.
It's an issue that won't be solved overnight. But in places like India, where Sharma is from, it's an attempt to work with a pollutant that's seemingly everywhere.
When you go back to India, you see it in your face. And for us, it did a big thing that, well, how do we utilize this problem as a solution itself? Air pollution knows no borders. It's a problem everywhere. We're trying to bring the technology everywhere it's required right now.
Tina Trin, VOA News, New York.
17 girls of Ashley Hall School in South Carolina sailed for the first time on a week-long voyage as part of a course to build their confidence and leadership skills. VOA's Isha Sarai followed their journey.
Many of these teenage girls have never set foot on a boat, but they are embarking on a week-long voyage as part of a program to take them out of their comfort zone and help boost their confidence.
The offshore leadership program really focuses on leadership skills, and of course it is about, you know, being on the boat and on the water and stuff, but it's really about teaching girls kind of about like finding themselves and bringing out their confidence.
It's obviously going to be a very difficult trip. It's, you know, it's a lot to spend a week on a boat after, you know, I have absolutely no sailing experience. I've never done anything like this before.
Seasickness and homesickness are among the challenges.
I've got this nice top bunk, and then Celia has this really nice bottom bunk.
Yeah, my biggest fear is just kind of being away from home, so far away out in the middle of, you know, 20 miles offshore. I miss my dog, my family, but I'm really excited to get to know everyone.
The 17 students from the independent girls' school Ashley Hall sailed from Norfolk, Virginia to their hometown of Charleston, South Carolina in 1 week. During the trip, they pushed themselves and each other to brave cold weather and hard labor, often on little sleep.
You're waking up at 2 o'clock in the morning and having to put on your gear and sit out in the cold. We didn't have our phones, like there was no outside connection whatsoever.
They were sort of apprehensive at the beginning, and they realized that they could do it, and they worked around the clock, did an outstanding job.
I'm outie. You love me, Hamie.
Honestly, sometimes the hardest part was being able to like visualize that we would actually be here in Charleston. For so much of it, we were literally just in the ocean, and the ocean looks the same a lot of the places where you are. Honestly, I learned, I think, besides all the terminology, just how to be confident in things that I do outside of my comfort zone. And really knowing that once I commit myself to embracing everything that it had to offer, I knew that was how I was going to get the most out of this experience.
But until their next time out to sea, these girls are just happy to be home. Isha Sarai, VOA News, Charleston, South Carolina.
And if you've been paying any attention to U.S. news reports, you know that people have been lining up to buy lottery tickets. I went to the grocery store a little bit earlier today, and people were crowded around the machine to the point where it said this terminal is no longer able to dispense tickets. The Mega Million numbers have been drawn, but the next jackpot could top $2 billion if there's no winner. You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. You can like us on Facebook, and you can also follow us on Twitter. We are at VOA_IE. What would you do with $2 billion? I wonder. Asking our director, that's Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns, I'm pretty sure he would buy him a Peter Criss autographed set of Pearl drums. Thanks for being with us again. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Enjoy the rest of your day.